This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me today. Sean Brock said about his new cookbook that his goal is, quote, helping people everywhere understand that Southern food should be considered among the most revered cuisines of the world. His new book, South, Essential Recipes and New Explorations, has more than 125 recipes representing the diversity of the American South, balancing history with innovation. He uses the ingredients indigenous to America's Deep South and specific to each region. There are classic dishes like grits and cornbread and fried bologna, but he doesn't hold back adding modern flavors to the plates of his family's past. Papers stuck together. Here we go. You might know the author as host of PBS's Mind of a Chef, or maybe you saw him in the most recent season of Netflix's Chef's Table. Today is Pub Day for South. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And Sean Brock will be in conversation with Kat Kinsman for an event tonight at the Bell House in Brooklyn. For more information, you can visit our website. So happy to see you. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when you say you want to help people understand Southern cooking, what are some of the misconceptions that you really wanted to dispel with this book?
You know, it really started when I was able to start traveling around the world. I noticed that when I started to speak about Southern food or tell people about Southern food, everyone had this idea of it being one cuisine that was very unhealthy. And that just really frustrated me. And so I've kind of made it my mission to dig deeply into the historical side of things, but also look at the future to help realize how diverse Southern food really is.
Why do you think that that stereotype about Southern food has been exported like that? Is it just there haven't been the right ambassadors? Is it convenient?
My theory is, when Southern food was being born and when it was in its infancy, it was this really vibrant cuisine because the ingredients hadn't been genetically engineered yet and they were insanely flavorful. Once we got into World War II and the Great Depression, we had to start changing our agricultural practices to breed for convenience rather than flavor. Well, we still crave this kind of comfort from food. And if it's not there from the natural deliciousness, it can be there from adding cheese or cream or bacon fat.
Or lard or...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting. The idea that you had to try to create what nature actually had delivered to us, but we ignored or progress took us away from.
Yeah, Mother Nature purposely makes the most nutritious food the most delicious food so that we're drawn to it. And if we breed out deliciousness, we're just eating not healthy food.
Thank you for not saying what you were going to say. What do you think sets American Southern cooking apart from other American cuisine?
Well, if you start talking about American cuisine, there's very few regions that are as diverse as the South. If you break off the South from the United States and pretend it's its own country, and you place that, and there's a picture in the book, you place that beside continental Europe, they're almost the same size. And if you think about how many different cuisines are in continental Europe, why can't there be that many cuisines throughout the South? And they're all little nuanced things, but they all tell the story of the people who are from that place and its history. And each place has its own distinct voice and flavor.
You describe them as micro-regions in the South. So for someone who's thinking about trying to wrap their head around this, how is, say, food from Charleston distinct from food from Savannah? Because on the surface, they might look similar.
Yes. So I was able to spend a lot of time in Savannah studying the cuisine there before I opened a restaurant there. And I'd spent many, many years in Charleston. And even based on all the research I've been doing my whole life, I still kind of assume they're pretty much the same thing. But it turns out they're not. There's these clues that start to pop up that show the social differences, the cultural differences that end up on the plate. And that's when you can really start discovering all kinds of neat things about each city and the people who live there and its history and its traditions.
Yeah, I think, isn't there the old saying about Charleston, they ask who your preacher is, and Savannah, they ask who your bartender is? Something to that effect. Well, someone in the audience will know that saying.
Savannah had a much different start. It was like this utopian, crazy, there was all these laws. There was no lawyers, no slavery, no booze. Like, it was this, it was completely different than Charleston. And so that affects the food. Of course, we all know Savannah is now as alcohol. But it's neat. And I talk about it in the book. And I use whiting, this fish, as an example. In Charleston, you would never see it in a restaurant because it was always associated with people who had to catch their own food. Well, if you go to Savannah, that is the fish of Savannah. It is everywhere. That social quirk never made it there. It's still the same fish. It's a still very similar region. It's still incredibly delicious. But it's just bizarre how those things get stuck in people's head.
My guest is Sean Brock. The name of his book is South: Essential Recipes and New Explorations. So when you decided to sit down and write this book, what from your personal history as a Southerner did you want to infuse in the book?
Well, I spent 12 to 15 years in the Lowcountry of South Carolina in Charleston, but I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains. And those two cuisines couldn't be more different. Absolutely opposites. And that has always fascinated me. It started fascinating me when I first went to Charleston as a teenager to go to culinary school. I couldn't believe that the people in Charleston had never heard of the traditions, had never had a pawpaw, or had never eaten sour corn. I thought everyone ate that. So that really was, I think, the first time I realized how special the food of my home was, but also how diverse the South was.
Now, when you talk about Southern food, how is it different than soul food?
Oh, see, for me, they're the same thing.
They are the same thing.
Yes, because I think Southern food carries one, there's a thread that runs through it all, that holds it all together, and that is the emotion created that we refer to as soul food or comfort food or grandmother food. It's a very particular emotion that the person cooking that food is striving for. I think that's my favorite thing about it.
In your recipes, you stretch a bit. You're not afraid to stretch a bit, I should say. So this is beneath your recipe for Sea Island red pea spread. You said, "What would hummus look like if it came from the South?" Tell us about this recipe a little bit.
Yeah, so I think to keep traditions alive, you have to play with them and make them interesting to keep people's attention. And so why not be inspired by other cultures and the recipes of other cultures, trying them with our ingredients, because those ingredients are capable of anything. They're world-class ingredients with complex flavors and can be translated across so many cuisines.
When you think about, you said our ingredients, when you think about what Southern ingredients are, rattle off a few for me.
The first thing that comes to mind for me is the tradition of Three Sisters. And that's an agricultural practice of planting bean seed, a corn seed, and a squash seed in the same hole. And they grow together and they support each other. But that also kind of shows how cuisines are formed. That is an agricultural practice that really thrives in the South. And so it ends up on the plate. And so corn, beans, and squash, which I have tattooed on my arm, are always the first ones I think of. And then sorghum. I think sorghum is so unique to the South. And most people have never had it. They've had molasses, but that's a completely different plant and a completely different flavor.
Tell me more about sorghum.
So sorghum, as it grows, it actually looks like a stalk of corn. And then it puts off this seed head that can be used as a grain, which is actually very delicious as well. But it gets juiced, usually through horse-drawn carriage. The juice is then boiled over a live fire until it's the perfect viscosity and the perfect flavor, and it's skimmed the whole time, and it becomes this amazing tradition where for the communities to get together and stay connected. But I think it tastes like, I think if you were to say, what does sunshine taste like? That's sorghum.
My guest is Sean Brock. The name of his new book is South Essential Recipes and New Explorations. All right, let's talk essential recipes. Cornbread, page 216. You give me all kinds of options on cornbread. Let's just talk basic cornbread. Is there something that you have to do to make sure it turns out right?
Well, cornbread is a great example of how ingredients that thrive in an area start to form that cuisine, because wheat doesn't like to grow in the South. So a lot of our table breads are based on corn. And that's where it starts to get complex. As you travel throughout the South, you'll see so many different kinds of cornbread that match that place. Its flavors, its traditions, the cultural influences of each individual place. So it's like, it's a source of great, great debate. Do you put sugar in it? Do you put flour in it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you put eggs in it? Do you put cracklings in it? But then when I started opening restaurants in different cities throughout the South, I used cornbread as a way to tell the story of that place. As an example, in the Lowcountry, most people would fold in the leftover rice. Rice was such an important crop, still is. You fold the rice into the cornbread, and you get this corn rice cake that's just amazing. In Appalachia, we have a lot of German immigrants, and so we're born into tasting a lot of sour things. So I put a fermented cornbread recipe in there. If you go to Nashville, the home of the Meat and Three, the cafeterias, you'll see cooks smashing in their hands this polenta-like cornbread and frying it, and that's hot water cornbread. So that's basically water and cornmeal.
Yeah, my grandmother's from North Carolina, and you know she had certain things what cornbread is and what cornbread isn't, and people feel very strongly about it.
Oh, and what you put on top and what you're able to spread or drizzle. All very serious business.
Is there any Southern-ism or old-school Southern thing that you would probably never see in a kitchen now that you wish could come back if there were no health inspector? I mean, I'm thinking of my grandmother's grease can with the bacon grease that after she made bacon, she poured it in there and they used it for everything.
I have an enormous one above my stove at home, and we have them in the restaurants as well. I mean, I'm not sure what the health department would say if they found that. We don't do it.
You allegedly have them.
Yes. No, that's a great one. I mean, that's a sign of a good Southern cook when you walk into the kitchen and you see that.
You have traditional shrimp and grits. Is that, I don't want to say how to make grits. I want to ask you, how do you not mess up grits?
So, cooking grits is very difficult.
It is, yes.
Because they take forever to cook, so you run the risk of scorching them. But I think it starts with the selection of grits, the selection of the corn and the person milling the corn and where it's from. And each region has a different corn that does great there and different milling techniques, finer or more coarse. Then you get into cooking it. Is it very simple? Does it have dairy? Does it have cheese? What I've discovered is using slow cookers or rice cookers, the Instapot kind of thing.
Oh, that's smart.
Just put it in there. Not worry about it. Because in the restaurant kitchens, we have to cook such large quantities on these raging hot stoves. The rule was you walk past the grit pot, you have to stir it. Because you could be cooking these grits for like 2 hours and the guests are waiting to eat them and then they get scorched at the last minute. You're not serving grits that day.
So I don't know how you pronounce it. I pronounce it fried bologna.
Yes.
Is that how you pronounce it as well?
Fried bologna.
Yes. The recipe is sort of funny because it says, makes 12 slices. Mm. half a recipe bologna from this page, 2 tablespoons unsalted butter, but you include a pickled peach mustard. What is the history of fried bologna? And then tell me about the pickled peach mustard.
So that was one of the first things I remember cooking as a kid and putting in a skillet and frying up, and then it would like turn into a bowl, which you could also put eggs in. But as I started getting...
The bologna bowl.
Yes, a bologna bowl. As I started getting into charcuterie, I wanted to know how to make my own bologna, and it is so hard. That's the most difficult recipe in the book. It's a great example of the things we take for granted when they're just on a supermarket shelf. But making bologna, I mean, it's so much better. But it's a great lesson in that. And I wish you could have seen me in Italy working in the kitchen at Osteria Francescana, trying to explain to the team there in the kitchen what we do with bologna in the South. Like, we fry it in a pan, and then we get real squishy white bread and lettuce and tomato and lots of mayonnaise. And they looked at me like I had 2 heads.
I want to ask you a little bit about the art direction of the book, because you have these beautiful photos, but then you have these interesting maps. We were sort of giggling about the country ham map.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you wanted to assemble this book. What was important to have in it to be able to tell this story you're trying to tell, Sean?
So many cookbooks are really hard to cook from because they're these complex dishes with several components. And so we took the idea of, we want people to be able to use this as like a field guide to go shopping, find the best products, and then come back to this book and say, well, I have peaches. Whoa, I can make pickled peach mustard. And so it's laid out that way in these foundational, simple recipes that truly are the recipes that I start with when I'm cooking in restaurants or at home. So it's a lot of my like tips and tricks and secrets.
My guest is Sean Brock. The name of his new book is South Essential Recipes and New Explorations. You have so much going on right now. You've got something going on in Nashville. You've got this cookbook. And you are someone who is in recovery.
Yes.
Given where you were 5 years ago, does today seem possible?
Wow. It doesn't seem real. I'm a completely different human being. And I make decisions differently, and different things matter now. I just became a father, and that's been just the most amazing thing. And I've taken the last year off from restaurants because I want to take better care of myself for the first time. And it's changed the way I want to set up my next restaurant. It changes the way I cook. It changes the way I see the day.
Is there something about your industry that is difficult for people who struggle with addiction?
Well,
very specifically about the industry.
So imagine throughout the day, something makes you really upset and you feel it in your chest, you feel it in your stomach. That's your nervous system dysregulating. Now do that for 15 hours a day, for 6 days a week, for 20 years. Something's gotta give. Something's gotta bring you down from that. Something's got to balance you out. And there are lots of booze around restaurants. And that's just what you're taught to do.
How did you unlearn all that? What did you, I don't want to say substitute's not the right way, but how have you learned to handle that kind of stress given the industry?
I am now realizing that I get to decide how stressful things are. And in creating this restaurant, we're starting with this idea, this question, this phrase of, well, how stressful is that? So every decision we make is based on how stressful the consequences of that decision are. And I think if we look at it and have that mindset, we can create a place that's safe and secure and a place that you can grow.
And this is the new Nashville restaurant
Yes.
you're talking about. Does it have a name yet?
There are 2 restaurants in one building, 2 restaurants and a bar and a research development kitchen, a mindfulness center, a podcast studio. I've created my own little
Brock Enterprises,
little cultish compound in East Nashville. And downstairs, the restaurant's called Redbird, and it will be a casual comfort food restaurant focusing on Appalachia. And upstairs will be a smaller tasting menu only restaurant.
And is the Mindfulness Center, is this is part of your mission to give back, to try to help people who find themselves in the situation you found yourself in?
Yeah, it's exactly what we were just talking about. It's a way to keep yourself grounded and centered and clear-headed and happy and healthy. It's a room that can go into full of tools to be able to help you relax.
Today is Pub Day for South for Sean Brock. He'll be in conversation tonight with Kat Kinsman at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Sean, congratulations on the book and everything
Thank
going on
so
in Nashville.
Much.
On the way, WNYC planning editor Kate Hines gives us the scoop on what our reporters in the newsroom are covering this week. You're listening to All of It. We'll be right back.